You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Folks, Mother's Day is around the corner, and let me talk to you about 1-800-Flowers. I can't wait. Every year, it's a tradition. I send stuff to my mother, my mother-in-law, and my wife because they are three amazing moms. They're better than all your moms out there. You think you have good moms? No, I have good moms in my life. I'm just kidding. This was a little harsh. I'm sure you guys all have good moms too. From your mom to the mother of your children and all the moms in between, this Mother's Day, give back to the ones that have given you everything. 1-800-Flowers helps you celebrate all amazing moms, from homemade bouquets, sweet treats, gourmet food, and one-of-a-kind gifts, ordered easily and delivered fresh. For a limited time, you can save up to 40% off Mother's Day bestsellers at 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan. Don't wait. Order today and save up to 40% at 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan.
Well, we left our homes up in Bristol Bay for the waters of Miami shore. With a hippo at the helm and our severance pay, we fly the pirate flag once more. Pirate radio with the ship and crew, we get wind in our sails and the sky is blue. There's a devil up our nose, so much work to do. Pirate radio. Well, the ship is a wreck, shit stains the deck as Michael Hollow's fellas make more. And Billy is a worry that he's got the scurvy, cause Chris ate all the limes in store. Pirate radio with the ship and crew, we get wind in our sails and the sky is blue. There's a devil up our nose, so much work to do. Pirate radio. Now Roy is a chum when he's on the rum, he's the glue when we spring a leak. And Stu is a mess, he does less and less, and Greg's sounding worse each week. Pirate radio with the ship and crew, we get wind in our sails and the sky is blue. There's a devil up our nose, so much work to do. Pirate radio. Someone yelled ahoy, who the hell's cabin boy? Somebody named Tony, who knows? Once we got the skip, well, a mean jump ship, cause he knew we would sail to gold. Pirate radio with the ship and crew, we got wind in our sails and the sky is blue. There's a devil up our nose, so much work to do. For the pirate radio.
Here's the text I got from Dan. Won't be until late in your segment. Nothing personal.
Wow, we'll start there. Old school in it. It's weird that it classifies as old school when it's just me and David Samson, because that was a very much born out of the pandemic type of deal. But David, since I've got you to myself here for a little bit, let's get going with the interesting stuff, which is not the Marlins GoFundMe. We'll get there in a second. I want to begin with a review. You texted me that you watched Framing Britney. Now, for those in the audience that just tried to Hulu search Framing Britney, it might be a little confusing because it's a New York Times Presents show, which airs on FX, and they have that deal with Hulu. Fascinating, fascinating watch. I kind of felt guilty watching this one, the same way that I felt guilty watching Disclosure, David. For the audience, can you inform them about this very interesting documentary?
So let's start with the fact that I couldn't find it. So it was told to me by a listener of Nothing Personal, where I get great movie suggestions now and great ideas to please watch Framing Britney Spears. And you have to know that I am 52. So Britney Spears to me was a name. I remember her being a bit of a car wreck in terms of paparazzi. And I remember her having kids with Kevin Federline, and I couldn't name a song. That's sort of my relationship with Britney Spears. A little strange, I know, but when you're an Elvis Costello guy, that's sort of what happens. So I say, yeah, I'll watch it. So I go and I do a search function, and I have some new technology where you can press a button on your remote and you say Framing Britney Spears. And it popped up and then disappeared. And then I go searching in all the different streaming services. This is the new reality, right? Is it on Netflix? Is it on Amazon? Like, you don't know where it is. So then I find it finally, and it says New York Times, and that was the problem. So search New York Times Presents. So I sit and watch the hour and 16 minutes, which included commercials, which led me, by the way, to do Hulu Premium, because the number of commercials during the Framing Britney Spears was absolutely outrageous. It was every 3 minutes. Did you notice that, Mikey?
Towards the tail end, it got pretty absurd. By the way, just to supplement, one of those issues that I think a lot of people can relate to, especially if they were trying to find this show in particular, I might have suggested it to you in the past, Chris Whittingham, hat tip to you. You put this app on my radar. Just Watch. Just Watch. It's the name of the app. If you search a program that you want to see, it'll tell you exactly which streaming service that program is on. That program or movie will show up there, and it'll tell you exactly how to find it. Just watch.
Sponsor alert, sponsor alert.
I'm just trying to help people. I'm trying to help you.
No, no, I appreciate that. And you had given me Just Watch. And so I did Just Watch. And then I did just search, and it didn't just come up. Because if you don't have the right name when you're doing the search, in any case. So I'm watching this, and I had completely forgotten the role that paparazzi played in the world prior to the advent of camera phones when everyone became paparazzi. I had completely forgotten that her father had become her conservator because she had had some sort of what we were told or thought was a mental breakdown. I had completely forgotten that she had canceled her second Vegas residency. What I realized while watching is that we are the problem. We in the media, we as fans, we who believe that simply because someone is willing to give their time, skill, and talent to entertain us, that that means they are open fodder for every level of criticism, every level of scrutiny. The questions asked in some of the old interviews, the Ed McMahon question, I'm not going to spoil it. It basically made me feel as though I was a part of a time in the world where it was acceptable to be lecherous, voyeuristic, and disgusting. So I felt dirty, I felt upset, and I felt sad watching this documentary.
The interviews that she did abroad were jaw-dropping with some of the questions that were asked. And Matt Lauer and Diane Sawyer didn't exactly do much better. Diane Sawyer, I mean, that was one of the worst interviews in the whole thing.
I have great respect for Diane Sawyer. Actually was married to Mike Nichols, a phenomenal playwright and writer. I couldn't believe what she asked. What bothers me more about what they asked, and of course there's a whole level of watching Matt Lauer do an interview, knowing what Matt Lauer in his head knew exactly what he was doing in his place of business, and yet he is asking the question of Britney Spears that he was asking. Talk about living in the biggest glass house. I don't know how the guy went to bed at night. But I was thinking to myself, the reason why these questions are asked is because the people watching and the advertisers who spend money on advertising, that's the questions that they want to hear answers to. And it is sickening.
One of the lessons that I got from it, and I saw a couple of tweets about it, so I went in kind of skewed. One of the tweets that I saw was, has Justin Timberlake apologized to Britney Spears yet? And you really, in experiencing that documentary, you really realize the power of taking control of the narrative from the onset. It's sort of word association now. Britney was cheating on Justin. That is what everyone takes as fact. And even if it's true, it's not exactly fair, and it helps ruin someone's life, and it gears the narrative to all sorts of magazines and social media. Perez Hilton built an empire off of it. He got off easy on this documentary, by the way. And I wonder how Justin Timberlake views that documentary.
So, interestingly enough, I had never known or remembered that they were dating. And so wow. I'm watching. Isn't that amazing?
You were in a bubble. You don't remember the Canadian Tuxedo Award Show getup?
I do not remember any of it. So I'm watching it, and I'm looking at Justin Timberlake, and I'm thinking, I had just reviewed Palmer on Nothing Personal. And I've been a Justin Timberlake fan of his acting. I went to see him perform in a show. He's a great performer, a great actor. I mean, I love Jessica Biel, of course, having only met her once at Marlins Park, which is a whole nother story. Because it was one of the funniest times of all time.
We'll come back
and
to it.
It's a good one. And so I didn't realize what he had done to her, because it turns out that the first time anyone ever cheated in a relationship was the Justin Timberlake Britney Spears relationship. I didn't know that.
No, had no idea. That was the first time. Just like I had no idea about that. And Phoebe Bridgers also said, I can't believe I'm the first woman in the world, because she decided to break a guitar on SNL and the whole world exploded.
It's worth watching, Mike. And I know you watched it. I appreciate that you did. I think that the listeners should watch, because I think we all have to take a look, right? We talk about inflection points on Nothing Personal. We talk about it here on your show. When is the inflection point going to come when the level of intrusion of privacy and the level of fandom, if you will, and insanity, where social media now is, and you feel this, I know you do, and you feel the weight of the responsibility, and you and I, you are a C-level celebrity and I'm an F to a G to an H to a Z. The reality
is you have that dash of infamy that takes you a letter above.
Okay, so I'm X and you're Y. So people listen. People are interested, and we've got a platform, and you've got to use that platform responsibly. It doesn't mean we're going to be right all the time. It doesn't mean that people are going to agree with us all the time. But I think we have to recognize the ripple effect of the actions we take when the microphone is on, and the microphone is always on. And what they did to Britney Spears with those microphones on and with the cameras on, it is not human. Treated her like an animal. And I'd like to think that doesn't happen anymore in this world, but it does.
I knew that I was going to experience some level of guilt when I watched this. So here's, I shit you not, this was my experience. Before I started watching this, I Twitter searched my handle and Spears to see if I was a contributing factor to this. And I deleted some tweets. Nothing like that made fun of the mental stuff. It was really just performance stuff, but I didn't want to like have those tweets isolated because the public is really gathering behind her in this movement. It was really just like, yeah, I don't really like her voice, but I wanted to be safe. And then I experienced it. I realized I was overly cautious, but I understand the groundswell of support Britney Spears is getting. I will say, however, I approached everything with an open mind, and there's a lot of things about my behavior in experiencing that as it was a seminal part of pop culture at the time. I have my guilt about that. In terms of where I stand now about the conservatorship, I'm not exactly sure what the right call is there because an attorney that tried to represent her, Mr. Streisand, he articulates it beautifully. We don't know what we don't know. Obviously.
It's a great line. That's a great legal line, by the way. And he's covering up the fact that he probably does know more than he was able to disclose on the documentary. But that is the truth. I am not making a judgment about whether Britney should be free because I don't know. The laws of conservatorship, you have to realize that judges, they don't care that Britney Spears is famous. They don't care that she's got family issues. They don't care that she's got custody issues. None of that matters. None of that has to do with conservatorship. There is a belief, and it was very well defined in the beginning of the documentary, of what it means to be in conservatorship, just to teach the audience. That means that Britney Spears basically has someone who controls her finances and controls her quote-unquote person. That means that she cannot enter into any legal agreement without the signature and approval of her conservator, which is her dad. And that is the movement right now to A, get rid of her father, and B, because she doesn't want to get rid of the conservatorship, interestingly enough. She wants a neutral party like a bank, Bessemer Trust, in charge of everything, because generally when that happens, the person is really in charge, not the bank. But when it's a parent, it becomes a whole thing. I didn't realize Jamie Spears was such a Hollywood dad. Like, yeah. It reminded me a little of Richard Williams, didn't it?
It reminded me of Jessica Simpson's dad, and that's a whole nother ball of wax. But I do think that's a very interesting part of everything, that she's just arguing for a neutral party, and you could see that side of it. While a lot of people may come away with just a blanket takeaway, is like, wow, poor Britney, she's trapped. You can make an argument that the conservatorship really helped Britney Spears. They actually lay out an argument without skewing it that way, that it might have saved her life at the beginning, so you can't dismiss it altogether. The family dynamic and then the restraining order, the allegations from Kevin Federline that Jamie Spears assaulted one of the children or came close to it, obviously that's a complicated family dynamic, and you could say, well, the obvious middle ground here is a neutral party because you could see the benefits and the cons.
So there must be, therefore, because courts are neutral, there has to be a reason. Because watching the documentary and only learning sort of the top two layers, you would say, of course, keep her in conservatorship and then have a neutral party, have someone else be the conservator. But for the court not to do that, that means that not that Jamie Spears' lawyers are better than Britney Spears' lawyers. That's not accurate. It means there are things that are sealed in the case that we don't know.
I will say it does seem like it's accurate, though, because she tries to get a higher price lawyer and the court dismisses it and assigns her one. Meanwhile, she's paying for her lawyer and her father's attorneys as well. So I will say that she's going into this legal fight with an arm tied behind her back.
What about the 1.5% the conservator makes?
Yeah. That
was a little nugget in the documentary that wasn't really talked about. How about doing a little math where you figure out the amount of money, not that Britney made, but also that her conservator makes, which included that lawyer who has since resigned, which includes the dad, who, by the way, apparently, again, only from the documentary, so I have no proof, it's absolute hearsay, was not exactly a successful entrepreneur in the business world. He was more of a not that. And he all of a sudden ends up making a ton of money. It's one of the great issues that happens with child actors and child performers, and it's totally ignored. And it's the reason why child actors and child performers more often than not end up absolutely so screwed up, because the parents drive that train more than anybody else.
There's plenty of meat on the bone with the Marlins GoFundMe situation, and you've been pretty consistent here since the sale. The Marlins ownership group paid too much money. I'm going to save that for the very end of this podcast, because I imagine if Dan saunters in, he's going to want to touch on that. So I welcome
Time out. I only want to interrupt and tell you that I've known him as long as you have. I've never seen him saunter.
Oh, he saunters. He's a saunter.
I've never seen him saunter.
I welcome in Chris Whittingham here because, look, there have been a lot of embarrassing moments along the way when it comes to Inter Miami. Full disclosure, Chris Whittingham, not to put you in a difficult spot, but you call games for Inter Miami, so you are an employee of Inter Miami to some level of degree. I don't know if you got an LLC, that's complicated. But so David Beckham has taken a more active role here. With the ownership, they have fired their business operations. For the people that don't know, can you tell me, Chris Whittingham, the story of Inter Miami ownership after they actually began playing?
Yeah, so Jorge Mas, who was interested in buying the Marlins, although you have said on this show David didn't quite meet the asking price, takes over with Inter Miami, and it seemed as though he was kind of the main leader of the operation after a certain point. The pandemic has him as the only one here in Miami, so it kind of becomes his operation. And after a fairly sizable failing in year one, David Beckham has clearly decided, I'm going to start taking over, I'm going to start running some more things, hires his best friend to be the new manager of the team, Phil Neville, and now he's kind of putting his stamp on the organization.
And the business operations aren't exactly going the way everybody had planned. I mean, they have the one thing they got right is picking the colors, and no one's happy with the kits. they fire their technical director, who came in, Paul McDonough, came in with all sorts of respect for the job that he had done in Atlanta United. That blows up. Their manager gets fired, but not fired, and then fired. He leaves a meeting with the understanding that he was going to be fired, and then it just didn't happen. Sort of like Joe Girardi. He just sort of hung around a little extra, for a few extra months, actually, before they got clarification.
It's buyout negotiations. I'm sure David would know that.
Then you bring in Phil Neville, who is David Beckham's friend, who, if you look at just the wins and losses at his previous job with the English women's national team, he did a good job, but then I see Twitter and everybody hates him over there. They actually think he's held them back. So it's obviously been a messy start for Inter Miami, and you know quite a bit about this franchise. What is just your treetop view of everything right now, David Sampson, of what is going on over in Fort Lauderdale?
Well, when Jorge Mas joined with David Beckham, it was going to be a clash of egos from the beginning, because Jorge has a large, sizable ego. And in terms of what his view is of himself in Miami, my issue with Inter Miami, when we were thinking about getting involved with David Beckham and had plenty of meetings and conversations about it, is that one of the prerequisites for me to get involved and us to get involved was David Beckham's involvement. And the question was, will he ever spend time in Miami? Will he ever be interested in anything other than what's going on the pitch? Will he be willing to go to business meetings and help the business side of the operation? Because that really is the only chance that Inter Miami was ever going to have, was David Beckham being the real face of Inter Miami. And it was told pretty clearly to me that that was not his interest, that he was going to take charge of sort of the head of soccer operations, of football operations. That's what he wanted to do. Colors and the way the clubhouse would look and all the stuff that's really nice and cool. But that's not what keeps the lights on. So I'm not surprised that this has happened. And everything you've just described, it doesn't sound like David Beckham is changing his mind. I wanted a certain number of days that he would be in Miami during the course of a year, a certain number of meetings that he would be able and willing to attend. And that was never agreed upon. He would never agree to that. And that's really what made any sort of deal fall apart, because it was a non-starter. And my guess is he's still not agreeing to do it because he doesn't want to do those things because he's David Beckham.
That's very interesting, because I thought for a minute there, the reason why he was absent was the pandemic. He couldn't actually be here, but it doesn't take a lot of effort to put up an Instagram post. Like I had to Google to see if he was still owning the team. If there was a run of what was okay for him, he'd occasionally pop up wearing like training shorts. And then when they made the playoffs with a terrible record, let's be honest, it was an expanded playoff field. And I guess year one's a success because I made the playoffs, but it's just wholly embarrassing what happened to Inter Miami year one. And he wasn't really out there. I didn't know if he felt it was bad for his brand because it was a failure. And that might be some of it.
This was a business deal. Just to make sure that we understand, this is not about David Beckham wanting to give to Miami or wanting to be a part of the Miami business or social landscape or community. This had zero to do with Miami or Miamians or Floridians. This was about him having an option to purchase an MLS team due to his contract that he signed with Los Angeles. And that option had been extended and extended and extended and was about to run out. And the option meant that he could buy a team that was valued at $25 million, where other people had to buy teams that were valued in the hundreds of millions of dollars. This was straight business for Beckham.
Yeah, as poor as it's gone here for David Beckham, in terms of just what the team is valued at, it's already been an amazing deal for him because the team's probably home valued run at $300 million at this point.
It's a home. Just so we're clear, it hasn't gone poorly. When he looks at Inter Miami, it is an absolute slam dunk. He could care less if there's a ballpark in Miami at Mel Reese, which benefits Jorge Mas on the real estate side. Literally, if the team has to move to Vegas, if the team has to move to anywhere in the world, or if he just eventually turns around and sells it to someone who's going to move it, or maybe get a ballpark, get a stadium built somewhere. This is business for him, and it's been good business.
Young soccer beat writer Greg Cody of the Miami Herald wrote a story about the rumored Qatar sponsorship that ended up getting axed. You have some background on this. We talked about it a year ago, but Greg Cody starts asking a few more questions regarding this. David Beckham has now popped up as an ambassador for the Qatar World Cup. Obviously, he's the reason why that deal even got put on the table, and he ended up being talked out of it by certain powers that be over at Inter Miami because of the horrible human rights record of Qatar and also ties to Cuba, which would affect a South Florida team. What can you tell us about this, David?
So Qatar is interesting because they are the country of last defense. That is where we would go, or anyone would go, when you need money so desperately and you have no more lines of credit with the banks. You have no one domestically or even internationally who's going to invest. And all of a sudden you say to yourself, how far will I go against my principles? Forgetting Miami for a minute, forgetting Cuba, forgetting all that. How far am I willing to go? And as David Sampson, I realized that I was willing to go way further than I ever thought, because there had been lots of talks about having Qatar and Emirates become sponsors of the Marlins, naming rights sponsors, et cetera. And if the price had been right, and what I was charging was a Sampson guilt premium. So in order to do a deal with Qatar, it needed to be 2X what a Pepsi would do, because I had to be able to say to myself at 2 o'clock in the morning, when I'm staring at my inside of my eyelids, you had to do this for the team. They sent, I don't know if I ever told you this, they sent about 30 people to Marlins Park to learn how to build stadiums when they were several billion dollars over budget for building their soccer stadiums. And it was a bizarre day of meetings with them. It was clear that they had so much money. Have you ever been around people who just have so much money that they don't even understand how much money they have and none of it matters, but they realize they had no skill? That was what that day of meetings was like. What can we do? How much money do we need to throw in order to get all of these stadiums built for the Qatar World Cup?
No, I haven't.
It was insane. They're I don't know how that World Cup's going to go. I want to go. I've been to Qatar to visit troops. And as part of a Marlins visit the troops in 2011 with Logan Morrison and John Buck and Andre Dawson, and Jeff Conine, I can tell you that I was legitimately scared there. And it's a complicated place. It is a place that is full of racism. It is full of sexism, and it is full of prejudice. And it's not great. So that's, if I were invited there to the World Cup, would you go? Because I would not.
Ooh, that is. I think I would go if I had to work it, but I want to go to one of these as a fan, and I keep feeling like I missed the opportunity. I should have went to the one in Germany because that was like tailor-made. And I was like 21 years old back when it happened. I should have done that. I wouldn't go as a fan. And it's weird. You know, in the UK, when you go to a game and you have to wear neutral colors if you're not there to support the home team, kind of feel like I got to wear neutral colors out there in that part of the world, because if you're there for a World Cup and you're screaming USA down an alley, I'm not sure it's the greatest look. So I wouldn't go as a fan. If I had to work it, it'd be something different, and I have to consider it a little bit more.
You would need security.
Yeah.
By the way, you would never, I would never have you go, nor should you go without security.
Hey guys, it's Tony. I am very, very, very excited about the NBA playoffs. They have been incredible so far. Taylor, producer on the show, thanks to Game Time, took a 28-hour train ride to a Knicks game. Talking to Taylor, it was an awesome time going to the game, feeling the energy of the Garden, and I really want to get out there to watch a game in the Garden. And you know how I do it? Of course, the best ticket app on the planet, Game Time. Game Time is an authorized ticket marketplace of the NBA, which makes getting playoff tickets even faster and easier. Prices on the Game Time app actually go down the closer it gets to tip-off, with killer last-minute deals, all-in prices, views from your seat, which is a technology I love, by the way. Game Time has tons of last minute deals. You can save up to 60% off buying last minute for sports, concerts, comedy, theater. Take the guesswork out of buying NBA tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app today. Create an account. Use code DAN, D-A-N, for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem code DAN, D-A-N, for $20 off. Download Game Time today. Last minute tickets. Lowest price guaranteed.
Let's talk a little bit about the Jessica Biel story that you touched on, because you just mentioned meeting with people at Marlins Park. You met Jessica Biel and you said it was a funny story. Give us the deets.
So she came to a game and she called us. The way it works with celebrities, ironically, they want free tickets, of course. So that's just how it starts and ends. And the way I would decide which celebrities got free tickets and which celebrities didn't was solely based on who I wanted to meet. And that was it.
Really? Who'd you turn down? Who have you turned down that you had no interest in meeting?
So if there is a if there's a celebrity like a guy who's in, you know, comic book movies where it doesn't really, I don't really care, or an actor who is in a TV show like The Sopranos, which I've never watched, like I'm not that interested. And I admit it, this is how it is. If Jennifer Aniston's ready to go to a game, you get a ticket. So I get notification that Jessica Biel wants to come to a game. She wants to bring her friends. And here's how you know and who I want to meet. It's where they sit. Jessica Biel sat with her three girlfriends in the batter's box right next to where I sit. So that means that I had a very big interest in meeting her. So she comes to the game. If I didn't know Jessica Biel, she was just one of the girls, goes to a game. I, of course, then decide who I want to meet in person. So I get told by security, okay, she's coming now. She's on her way. She's here. For whatever I'm doing, whatever meeting I'm in, I got to go. I go down and I greet if it's someone I'm interested in. This is the major benefit, among many others, of being president of a team. So I go down and meet her, escort her in, give her sort of the private tour down below, and she sits in the batter's box. I'm trying to ingratiate myself. I'm trying to spend time, and she was so disinterested, disengaged, and I use disinterested purposefully. I use disengaged because that's the exact word. She was in another world. I don't want to say she was on drugs. I want to say that her level of interest in the Marlins, in meeting me, in meeting any fan, in meeting any player, in doing anything that I could offer that would give me some sort of advantage over the next schnook, was of zero interest to her at all. And that was, it was, I figured it out very quickly. And so, you know, I'm an investor in terms of my time. So I knew immediately that there was nothing I could do to turn this around. So I spent about 15 minutes with her, which was 5 minutes more than I should have, because after 10, I knew I had no chance at anything. After 15, I totally bailed and I went up to the suite. I didn't even watch the game in the batter's box because I couldn't even lock eyes with her. I couldn't even do anything. So she was nice enough. She was very understated, no doubt about that. But she was there with girlfriends, and it turns out the girlfriends dragged her there because they wanted to see Marlins games, and they knew they would get good seats.
Did you ever meet Jack White?
No. Who's that?
Who's? No, you're kidding me, right? You're kidding me, right?
Jack White?
Yeah, the White Stripes, Iraq on Tours, Jack White of, you know, like God of Rock music. Presently? Nope.
By the way, I'm learning
myself. You don't know who Jack White is?
Okay, can I just tell you that I watched a movie in the middle of the night last night, and it was called, and I'm not reviewing it now because I'm doing a full show on this, a movie called Guitar Man.
I thought you said Qatar Man, which is, no, is that about
David
Beckham?
Guitar Man.
Oh, all right.
So have you heard of Joe Bumabasa?
Yeah.
I had never. And I need to broaden my horizons. My musical interest stopped in the 80s, and I need now to realize there is such good music. There is so much out there that I don't know about, and I'm starting now, Mike. I'm starting now.
Well, I'll send you some Jack White tracks. He was in Walk Hard. He played Elvis Presley. He was in Cold Mountain.
Okay.
He was in a great documentary called White Stripes Under the Great White Northern Lights, which is one of my favorite rock documentaries of all time. He was also in It Might Get Loud. I think it's It Might Get Loud. And it's three expert guitar players just talking about guitars. It's with...
It's two expert guitar players and also The Edge, who didn't belong in there.
Hey, The Edge had invented a sound, but you're right. But if he invents a sound...
Hello, Dan.
He invents a sound.
I can't believe he doesn't know who Jack White
is. That's crazy
is.
To me.
I thought you said Jack Wagner.
It Might Get Loud. It's with Jimmy Page, The Edge, and Jack White. And they're just singing, sitting... I can't believe it. I feel like he's trolling me. Jack White's my favorite musician of all time. White Stripes are my favorite band of all time.
You started talking very fast.
I established early on that I'm on like that new Watermelon Red Bull. 28 grams of carbs. I'm not too happy about that. I gotta get the sugar-free version.
That's your issue. Your heart rate's a buck 70 right now, and you're worried about your carbs.
I'm soaring. It's a big day on the stock market, man.
Whittingham, put it on the poll. Is it a stunner that David Sampson has no idea who Jack White is?
He went to a Marlins game when he was touring South Florida because he was doing this whole tour every baseball park. Anytime he plays a gig, he goes to a baseball game. He made news with the Rack on Tours at a show in D.C. He went to a Nationals game, played a show, and the game went into extras. They actually came back to watch the end of the game.
So does this not match with the story we were just talking about? If I didn't know who that is, I would have no idea that he was at the ballpark and no idea of having to go meet him.
Well, it makes sense because I think he was sitting in the club section as opposed to the batter's box. So that
didn't come from me.
Dan, you'll be happy to know that I saved all the GoFundMe questions for the end, but we're not there yet. Judas and the Black Messiah comes out this weekend on HBO Max. I'm super excited for this movie. It might have been an Oscar contender if it were released a little earlier, which ties into a question about award season that I want to ask you because it's pretty lame because everybody was sitting on their good stuff. How excited are you for this film?
I'm excited for that in Nomadland. And it's still an Oscar contender. Don't forget that the nominations don't now come out until the middle of March, and any movie released up until February 28th is an Oscar contender.
Oh, great.
So it's not December 31st the way it used to be.
Oh, well, I did not know that. So this is prime Oscar bait, everyone's saying. The performances in this film, you can tell from the trailer. You get goosebumps watching the trailer. Did you watch The Little Things on HBO Max?
I did.
I
didn't like it.
Dude, has there ever been a worse movie with three Academy Award winners attached to it? Probably.
So you have to know the background of The Little Things. It was written in the 90s, and it took this long to get made. And that's what it was. It's very much a 90s movie. I actually had a conversation with Billy Corbin about it on the phone, believe it or not, recently. And we were saying that if we went into the hot tub time machine and watched it in the 90s, we would have liked it a whole lot better. But I'm worried that Jared Leto is now becoming is off the reservation in terms of the characters he's taking, in terms of the way he's being typecast. It is strange to watch Denzel Washington, who now is more grandfatherly, given all the great stuff that his son is now doing. And that's sort of strange in terms of my mortality and any sort of potential existential crisis I may be thinking of having at any day now. But the movie itself, Rami Malek, he's going to be Freddie Mercury to me, and I don't know what to do about it.
He was useless in this.
Rami Malek is incapable. He's a great actor, and he's also incapable of playing a normal person. He's just not convincing as a normal person.
It was so overacted. His role didn't have any personality, and he was just trying to add a spice and flavor of weird.
He needs to play a creepy character. I feel like Jared Leto has a bit more range, and if you just simply switch, even though Jared Leto got a Golden Globe nomination for his performance and was probably one of the lone bright spots of this film, if you switch the roles that Rami and Jared Leto
that
play...
That is such a good point by Mike.
I think the movie's better.
He's so right about that. If you make the bad guy, yes.
The young hotshot detective.
Freddie Mercury. If you make the bad guy Freddie Mercury, you've got a movie.
That's Academy Award winner Freddie Mercury to you, Dan.
I don't want to, we're not going to spoil the movie, but are you sure that Rami Malek is not a bad guy?
Well, no, you know what I mean. I don't want to spoil the movie. The ending was actually cool, but
the
movie
spoils the movie. You guys don't have to worry about spoiling the movie. They all spoiled the movie.
The last 25 minutes of the little things I actually enjoyed. It was getting to that last 25 minutes. I must have checked my phone like 20 times. I'm like, what is going on here?
That's how we rate movies now, right? The number of times you check your phone during the course of a movie.
I was so excited for it. How could it be bad? Rami Malek, Jared Leto, Denzel Washington, all Academy Award winners, and it is just a steaming turd of a movie.
That is not how I judge it. Not how many times I go to my phone. How many times do I hit pause so I could see how much time is left in the movie?
That's a good tell, too.
That is, I do that one a good amount.
Yeah, that's a new bathroom break.
If I do that more than once to you during a movie, your movie is shit.
What's your go-to there, David? Yeah, that's what it is.
I do that too, but I check my phone. I do it by checking my phone, but I also do hit the pause button in order to see how much time's left so I can allocate in my mind how long I have. And anything like if it's more than an hour five, I get concerned because an hour five to me, I'm like, all right, I'm just going to watch an episode of something. But I've done it with like an hour 34 left in a movie. And then you know you're
but
screwed
you're
because
so,
unlike you, I won't leave a movie in the middle.
That's what
ever.
I was going to say. You're so obsessive compulsive that now you're counting. I've got an hour and 5 minutes that I have to do this. Where if I get to an hour and 5 minutes, oh, I'm out. See you later. Not going to watch any more of this if my first pause on you leaves an hour and 5 minutes left.
I'm unwilling to do it. And I understand your point. And I frankly think that your way of doing it is much healthier. But I cannot walk out of a movie. I've never done it. I've never not done a movie to completion. Never.
That's crazy.
A lot is riding on Judas and the Black Messiah for me. Because so far, this HBO Max experiment of films going that were supposed to be theatrically released and ending up on the platform have not gone well. Lockdown was terrible.
So let's make sure we say it right. What they're doing is releasing it in theaters and on HBO Max at the same time. They leave it on HBO Max for 31 days only, and then it disappears off HBO Max and is then only in theaters, and then it will come back the way regular movies come back to those streaming services.
All right. Well, consider everybody lucky that the little things and lockdown are coming off of HBO Max. Did you enjoy? I thought Anne Hathaway was really going for it in lockdown, and that's all I can say about that.
I find her slightly annoying because she plays for the Oscar, I feel like, all the time in terms of her scenes. And I thought that there were four or five scenes in lockdown where she thought that the project they were doing during the lockdown, this was filmed actually during the lockdown, that they thought that they could be onto something. And hey, this is the scene where you could win the Oscar and you could just tell.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you're screwed.
Yeah, there was absolutely a scene there where you could tell like, oh, this isn't for the movie. This is for a reel.
I'm curious how Dave feels as the Golden Globes come out and you see that television has absolutely sort of infringed upon filmmaking and feels like it's coming for the crown of filmmaking in some ways, because television has always been looked down on by actors who do big screen stuff. And now that actors have realized, wait a minute, I could feed my narcissism by doing all the same work and getting eight episodes of something and having an 8-hour movie instead of a 2-hour movie that is a hit. I feel like television has made a resurgence in this respect, award winning and quality of content that I did not see coming.
It's that TV screens are now movie screens. That's really the difference, right? So the way we engage with celebrity and the way we engage with a moving picture is no longer just having to go to a movie theater. Don't forget the vigorish between a movie theater screen and your TV set 30 years ago was the size of the Grand Canyon. Now there are many people where the difference is de minimis. So movie stars realized, hey, I'm going to be seen in the light that I want to be seen in with the type of material I want to perform in, and I can do it on TV.
Before we get to this Marlon story, I just have to ask, you've never heard Seven Nation Army?
Oh, for sure he has.
You work sure. in sports and
no,
you haven't heard of the White Stripes.
You've heard that song.
You've had to have heard Seven Nation Army.
Play some of it for him.
Bum, 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 bum. Bum,
oh
bum,
my God!
Bum,
of course.
Bum,
by the
bum,
way,
bum.
I know that from the Miami Heat games.
Yeah, then you've heard of the White Stripes.
I had no idea that it was a song. I thought it was just their internal musicians doing that.
You thought that was DJ Irie?
Huh? Yes.
Who hasn't
As
been there
fact,
for about
I
10
did.
Years?
That's our generations. We will rock you. I don't.
That's unbelievable. That is shocking.
Okay.
No, of course I recognize now that you're doing it, and I know exactly when they played at Heat games.
You thought Pat Riley composed that?
Well, no, because I'm not sure he's a composer, among other things, but I did not know that it was a popular song. Why would I know that? I never knew. Did you know that the Chicago Bulls introduced themselves to Alan Parsons' project, Eye in the Sky?
Yes.
When it was happening?
I was supposed to think that Michael Jordan composed that?
He could rock the synth.
Are you making the sound on purpose of the lawyer and the cat video, Mike? When you're
the
shot?
Cat video is so great. We'll play that sound during the
Have you seen it?
Show.
Have you seen it, David? It's great.
Of
but
course.
In the middle of it, there's just an old person. 9 seconds in, the lawyer is just like realizing, oh, my God, I'm a cat. I'm a cat on the screen in front of the
I'm not a cat.
I'm not sure why that got so much attention, because people do filters. And I don't know if you've all tried to Zoom with your families during this pandemic, as I have, and older people in the families, they really don't know how to operate it. They don't know how to unmute themselves. The camera's pointed at their forehead. I mean, it's a whole magilla just to try to get your family on a Zoom. And I know you can appreciate that.
I don't think I have laughed harder this entire pandemic than at Stugatz's mother's funeral on Zoom. At the people, all the old people trying to figure out the Zoom at once, and all of them botching it, and you know, calling Harold into the other room, and you can hear them bickering, and it was simply magical, all of it.
It happened with my father's memorial service and Shiva as well, where there was a clear demarcation in terms of the demographics of who could figure out how to get on the Zoom and who could not, and how to do it, and how to unmute and then mute. And all you're trying to be emotional and you're hearing stories. We can't hear you. We can't hear. Unmute yourself. And they press a button and then their camera goes off. We can't see you. And this is all going on while people are crying and people are sort of trying to grieve. It's a very sort of bizarre, surreal experience.
Our condolences, by the way. We probably should have said something before now, just telling people. You're laughing now. Now look at what you've done. Now you're laughing at me. What am I supposed to do with that? You're laughing. Your father has died, and now you're laughing. And what am I supposed to do with your laughter?
Nothing. Just let it pass.
Okay. I wanted to get into this Marlon story with you, because I thought you took a particular delight in posting it yesterday and bringing it into our attention, where the Marlins are crowd. Well, you explain the story.
Okay, so a former employee, what Derek has never realized is that the employees who were there were all very loyal to me, because we treated them very well in every way. We may not have won as much on the field. We may have had our issues with players from time to time, but our staff was a family. And when Derek came in, he got rid of the family atmosphere, and the employees who worked there, both under us and under Derek, were not happy at all and continued to be unhappy, although there are very few of them left. And so what he's done is gotten rid of anyone with any ties to us. So what he also never realized is that people in the media, people in the business community, all were still loyal to me, because while my public persona may be that as of an ogre or a hard-blooded business person, I had relationships over the 16 years. So I get texted to me this GoFundMe page. And the question was, what is this? And I looked through it and I recognized immediately what it was. It was a young guy in player development for the Marlins who was trying to do something nice, had not gotten permission to do it, and had not suckered, although GoFundMe in theory could be a sucker play, had gotten some big people to donate under the theory that these furloughed employees for the Marlins needed money. What the Marlins have done is what all 30 teams have done. So this is not about the Marlins. There were people on Twitter being so angry and rude to me for no reason. I was not accusing the Marlins of not paying their employees. Everybody furloughed across this country. What I said was, it's going to get taken down because Jeter has no idea this is up and they're using the logo illegally, number one. Number two, MLB and Jeter will see it. They will be embarrassed, mortified, and it will be taken down. I never said that, hey, they need 20 grand. They're so cheap that they're going to the public for 20 grand because they won't pay their employees. My point was, it is so bad around baseball and Jeter is so removed from what goes on that this little guy, little, and I don't mean in stature, I mean in title, posts something on GoFundMe, not even realizing, because of the way Jeter runs his business, how inappropriate and wrong it would be. And that's what bothered me about the situation. So I went public with it. And by the way, did you notice it was taken down in minutes?
Yeah, because it was embarrassing, but I interpreted it the same way the audience or whoever it was that was ripping you was interpreting it, because I didn't exactly study it. I did assume that you were posting that simply to show, look, this is not very good. All of this is not very good. That's how I'm just saying, I didn't go a lot deeper than that. I was just saying, here's Samson putting out some news that makes Jeter look bad, and I didn't go much deeper than that.
Yeah, so you needed to go a few inches deeper. This is not, I would, in the position that Jeter's in, I would have had no choice but to furlough employees, because when there's no minor league season, why would you pay minor league managers and coaches and strength people, et cetera? I get it. But by the way, I would also have spoken to Jeffrey. And one thing that he did is we paid people very well, because my view always was I'd rather cut payroll by $5 million and give that to employees than overpay players. And sometimes I get overruled by Jeffrey, no doubt, but he was very generous in his pay scale to people at all levels of the organization.
We were talking earlier this week, oddly, and I was corrected by everyone in here saying that David Sampson, you cannot be classified as an ogre because ogres are always large, they told me. I didn't know that ogres were always large, but they were telling me that Shrek is the Tom Brady of ogres, and therefore no one can see you as an ogre. You'd be more of a troll.
Unfortunately, that's what people would say, because it's a height thing, because I'm 5'5", right? So I never associate ogre with height. I associate ogre with action, right? If you are a certain way and do certain things, that to me is what being an ogre is. A troll is not an ogre. I am not a troll. I may be the size of a troll, but I'm not a troll.
Well, I want to get into this with Mike, though, because something else that was happening in this segment that made me a little bit uncomfortable is that we really buried David Sampson, and he was a good sport, for not knowing who Jack White is. And I don't believe anybody likes the guy who reminds the other guy or woman, you haven't seen Training Day? What's the matter with you? Training Day. And we just did that to David Sampson. Nobody in that war, as people are viewing it, I think the audience sides with David Sampson and feels for him and not knowing who Jack White is, and thinks that you and me, Mike, are Jackass White for burying him for it.
It's Jack. This isn't Training Day. This is a Best Picture winner. This is Forrest Gump. This is Jurassic Park. This is Jaws. I mean, at least in my world, he's my favorite artist. I don't understand this. And now your next...
But you just said it. Stop right there. Yeah. That's it. At least in your world.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think people are going to back me up on this one. This one's pretty shocking.
Well, I backed you up on it, yeah. But then I immediately felt bad for David because of the number of times that I fall behind pop culturally with you guys, and you guys are making me feel bad because I don't know how much liposuction Cardi B has had.
Hey, can you explain, Levitard, why it is that you have to say every week on our segment that you feel badly for doing things to me that you basically are the architect of? I don't understand how you believe that you can be on both sides of this.
You, Dave, I'm so sorry.
Check out Nothing Personal with David Samson. Thank you for joining us again this week. David, we'll talk to you next week.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.